All right, guys, if everybody could grab their seats. Members, please, we're going to get started. Ben, could you please call the roll?
Representatives Atkins, Bernard, Chestnut, Dorworth, Eisnagel, Frezen, Frisch, Holder, Horner, Huckel, Jenny, Jones, Kerr, Legg, Nair, Precourt, Rogers, Roussan, Shank, Workman, Chair Weatherford.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, a quorum is present.
All right, great. Show Representative Frezen is excused. Members, we're going to, first I want to thank you all for being here. As the speaker said, I know everybody was probably enjoying their downtime and decompressing, but hopefully this will be short and sweet, and I think the speaker gave us a good timeline, but I'm going to walk you through a few things. The first is, as far as today, we're going to cover only the ground that we need to cover today and during the course of these 15 days in order that the House and the legislature overall can address what the Supreme Court of Florida said, and that there are constitutional deficiencies in the Senate map, and that was adopted by the legislature just a little over a month ago. As you know, last Friday, the court validated the House map but invalidated the Senate map. So pursuant to the state constitution, the legislature must meet in order to craft the remedies to the state Senate map. For today, I have asked that our redistricting special counsel, Mr. George Muros, provide us with an explanation of the guidance provided to the legislature by the Supreme Court in order that this committee can be informed about what really is the first comprehensive interpretation of Florida's new redistricting standards. I would like to upfront state that it is my desire to let the Senate take the lead in this process. Notably, the Supreme Court even addressed that very question and said that there's nothing wrong with one legislative chamber deferring to another on its respective map. The results are what actually matters. At the same time, it is important that the House be able to scrutinize the results of the maps that come from the Senate. To that end, you can expect that the House will use March 26th, 27th, and 28th, that's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, to conduct its formal business regarding the revisions to the Senate map. In other words, we will not meet at all next week. The following Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, expect to be here in Tallahassee for a possible committee meeting and certainly time for the floor. In addition, like any issue before the House, all 120 members have the opportunity to file amendments, as long as they are consistent with the call of this extraordinary apportionment session. To that end, everyone received an email on Monday from the House bill drafting with reminders about the House rules with regards to redistricting bills and amendments. With that, members, if you take a look at your packet for today's meeting, you will find several tabs. In tab one, it contains the actual court order that Mr. Muros will be referencing when he speaks in a few minutes. And in tabs 2 through 5, there will be reference materials. There will be maps and data, bill analysis related to the state Senate map that was passed during the regular session. Now, with that, if there's any questions, we'll address those questions now, and then we'll have Mr. Muros speak to us. Is there any questions in regard to anything I said or something else that was not touched on? I believe Representative Jenny has a question. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical question in terms of how the bills will travel through the process. I understand we're going to defer in some way to the Senate. So will then the Senate subcommittee hear the bill over here, then this full committee, then onto the floor? Would that be the path for the bill?
The determination has not been made. My assumption is the full committee would meet. If there's going to be a committee meeting to scrutinize the bill, whether it's in a workshop format or a format where we would vote the bill out of committee, it would be this committee here probably. So that the Senate committee probably will not meet again specifically. A lot of that is for time purposes, so it doesn't have to go through two committees. So this would be the committee that would go through. Any other questions, Representative Clark Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And giving the dates that we would be coming back, you were saying that the committee would probably meet on the 26th and the 27th and the 28th. The entire House would meet?
Well, like I said, a lot of this is are based off of assumptions. But I think right now the way we're planning it out for purposes of members of this committee, we would have a committee meeting most likely if we were to have one on that Monday, the 26th. So what we would ask you is kind of keep that day open in case we need you here for that. Obviously, second reading takes a day and third reading takes a day, so you would need 2 days on the floor to actually pass the maps. And so if we had a committee meeting, for example, on Monday, you would need Tuesday and Wednesday to have second and third reading. And so that's how we envision it taking place, but I would not lock anything in stone. I think it's fluid. We want to have flexibility depending on what comes over from the Senate, but I would say those 3 days should be the days we should be watching.
Thank you.
Representative Precourt for a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate and am wholly supportive of the idea of giving deference to the Senate on drawing their maps. But similar to the process, the very open process that we used in making our staff accessible to the members to see what was going on, to ask questions, provide input, is the Senate going to make their staff open and available to House members to participate in this process as well?
That's a very good question, and one that I have not asked them yet. I think our staff is communicating with theirs. I'm communicating with the chair of the Senate as well. So that is actually a question that I have not, has not been asked yet. I think it's a fair one. A way to potentially do that so we don't overwhelm Senate staff while they're trying to draw maps is maybe to communicate with our staff. If our members of this committee or members of our chamber have questions or suggestions on how to improve the map that the Senate is working on, we can create a process where maybe we communicate that through our staff so we don't overwhelm the Senate. But that is a very good question, and we'll get an answer to you. Any other questions, members? Okay, great. Thank you. With that, Mr. Miros, if you could, please come forward. We've got, I believe, a bit of a presentation that you're going to give us. And thank you for your diligent work. Mr. Miros and his team have done just a tremendous job representing the Florida House, and in large part our maps being unanimously supported by the Supreme Court is certainly a lot of credit goes to our general counsel, who did a great job. So, Mr. Miros, thank you for your effort on behalf of the state of Florida and for the House of Representatives. You did a phenomenal job. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want you to know that staff and you and members of this committee and Speaker Cannon made the job very, very easy. With that, let me just give you a brief overview of where we've been and where we are now. Excuse me. On February 9th, the legislature passed Senate Joint Resolution 1176. On February 10th, the Attorney General submitted that to the Supreme Court for its constitutionally required automatic review of the plans. On February 17th, proponents and opponents of the bill submitted briefing to the Supreme Court. A second round of briefing back and forth occurred the following week. On February 29th, the court heard 3 hours of oral argument, 1 hour more than occurred in Bush versus Gore. And on March 9th, the court issued a 191-page majority opinion. In all, with concurrences and dissents, the decision totals 233 pages. We certainly are still reviewing the opinion for a complete analysis of it. What I can do today is to try to highlight the major holdings and the conclusions and some of the factual matters resolved by the court so that you can have some idea of where the Supreme Court has come out. The first standard in Tier 1, of course, is if the legislative body has an intent to favor or disfavor a political party or incumbent. The court made a number of findings in that regard. It said that there is no acceptable level of intent. Any inappropriate intent, whether on the plan as a whole or an individual district, is determinative and would invalidate a map. The court also said there's not one piece of evidence that is determinative regarding intent. There are some factors that are probative and relevant. One does there appear to be consistent compliance with the standards? If so, that's an indicative of a lack of improper intent. On the other hand, if there's a disregard for standards or an inconsistent application of standards, that can be indicative of lack of intent. The shape of a district in relation to an incumbent's address can be indicative of improper intent. And there, obviously, if you have a district that's reasonably compact, but there's a curlicue here or a finger there that happens to include an incumbent, that can be indicative of improper intent. Importantly, a political imbalance in the map, where at the end of the day it favors Republicans in elections or favors Democrats in elections, is not indicative of an improper intent. There was a lot said by the opponents that what this did was require a political balance in the map, and the court says that is not the standard, and that is not a standard in the Constitution. The knowledge of where an incumbent lives, or the lack of knowledge of where an incumbent lives, is not really probative of an improper intent. The court made that finding as well. And in that regard, possession of or use of political data in the drawing of maps is, again, not an indication of improper intent. The court focused substantially on the issue of if there appears to be compliance with Tier 2, and there is a way to comply with the Tier 1 requirements while also trying to comply with Tier 2 to the extent possible. That's a solid indication of a lack of improper intent. If, on the other hand, one is using Tier 1 as a shield against implementing Tier 2 when it is not clear that you have to do that to comply with Tier 1, that's an indication of improper intent. With regard to the minority protections, which is the second element of Tier 1, the court confirmed that our Amendment 5 standards essentially mirror the standards of the Federal Voting Rights Act. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the vote dilution requirements under the Voting Rights Act, and then Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the non-diminishment provision. Now, importantly, the court found that a Section 5 diminishment standard applies to all 67 counties in Florida. But see, it is equally important to understand that it is not federal law that does that. It's state law. So it is not that the 67 counties are subject to some sort of preclearance requirement. It is the same legal standard, but it does not go through the same process. The court also found that Section 5 should be interpreted in accordance with the congressional intent reflected in the 2006 reenactment of the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and the Congress's rejection of the decision in Georgia v. Ashcroft. And so in that regard, what the court said is that majority-minority districts must be recognized, and one may not weaken other districts that are not majority-minority that have historically performed for a minority candidate. A slight change in majority voting age population might not result in diminishment, but the standard will be, and this is consistent with what we advised this committee early on, is the minority population in a district more, less, or just as able to elect a candidate of choice. If by virtue of a change in a district, a minority candidate is less able to elect, that would result in diminishment. In reviewing minority districts, the court took into effect voting age population, voting registration data, voting registration of actual voters, and election results history. The court noted what is described as a functional analysis in Department of Justice guidance to those who are drawing maps, and that functional analysis is a fact-specific district-by-district analysis of these very issues and others to try to determine actually what is the minority voting strength as a matter of fact based on a number of circumstances. The standard for contiguity is the same now as it was before, so there's really no reason to get into that. Now, going to the Tier 2 standards, the first standard there is the obligation to have population nearly as equal as practicable. What the court there said was, and it, to some extent it appears to be stronger than what it was in 2002, and that any deviation from exactness in population must be justified by conformance with and faithfulness to the other standards in Tier 1. However, in doing so, the court indicated a flexible approach to that. The court noted that what the House did was, in following county lines, it started with Charlotte County. The population there is approximately 2% higher than perfect population. And then in Lee County, it kept four cities whole, and the population disparity there was 1.9, I believe. And so a disparity of 3.9% was okay because there was an effort to comply with county boundaries. So to the extent there's a reasonable good faith effort to comply with other standards, then a deviation of 3.9 at least is certainly acceptable. compactness. Here, the court did make some findings about what is appropriate in terms of compactness and what is not. The court defined the obligation of a compact district to be geographic rather than functional. And the goal, and I'll quote from the court, is to ensure that districts are logically drawn and that bizarrely shaped districts are avoided. Now, that's pretty general, and so it's not entirely clear how you do that. Districts can be evaluated on a visual basis and by applying mathematical measurements. The court used two measurements, the REOC standard and the convex hull standard, without indicating that those are the only two relevant standards. There can be others. Importantly, the compactness, as we argued, the compactness standard has to be assessed in connection with the other Tier 2 standards and Tier 1 standards, and the obligation can be mitigated to some extent by compliance with other standards. For instance, Tier 1 minority districts do not have to be as compact as areas where there's not significant minority population. The need to comply, or the preference to comply with county boundaries or city boundaries, can offset areas of a district that appear not to be compact. At the end of the day, what the court said, and this is consistent with what one would think, is an odd-looking district has to be subject to close examination. One has to look and say, are there legitimate non-protectural reasons for a district looking odd, having fingers, or having irregular shapes? With regard to political and geographic boundaries, the court did lay down some bright line rules. The court accepted the House's view of appropriate political and geographic boundaries by saying counties, cities, rivers, railroads, interstates, and state roads are appropriate geographic and political boundaries. It said that creeks or minor roads are not appropriate political or geographic boundaries for use in districts. Notably, the court did not require adherence to VTDs, voter tabulation districts, or census-designated places. The opposition submitted a map with adherence to census-designated places, and I would suggest that the court has said that those are not appropriate boundaries for consideration. Other rulings of interest. I said a little bit about this before. The very notion of partisan imbalance does not, number one, is not a standard. The notion that fair districts in this means partisan equality is rejected by the court. A partisan imbalance, if caused by other compliance with other standards, is legally irrelevant and does not give rise to a notion of improper intent. If there is inconsistent compliance with the standards, or irregular districts that appear to unpack or to pack adversaries, that can be indicative of improper intent. If the legislature draws a map and recognizes that it is highly imbalanced in a partisan way, it is not required to undo that. We argued, and appropriately, that would be favoring or disfavoring a party or incumbent, and the court certainly accepted that. And so one is not, the body is not required to do that. There were assertions that the House and Senate's early resistance to Amendments 5 and 6 indicated some level of malintent. Court said that is not legally relevant at all. The court opponents also suggested that the House's willingness to defer to the Senate and to have the Senate draw a map is somehow indicative of improper intent. Court rejected that out of hand. A few other findings. The failure to adopt an alternative plan is not indicative of improper intent. The court made it clear in a number of instances that it is not a matter of what is the best plan presented. If the legislature has presented a compliant plan, that is all that is required. an alternative plan can be relevant to assessing whether there is a way to comply with standards, which perhaps the map drawer is saying was not capable of being done. And so it can be probative of lack of compliance, but there is no such thing as a best map. It did say, for good or for ill, that the pairing of incumbents shows a lack of intent. And to the extent there are incumbent pairs, that can show an effort to comply in good faith with the standards. The failure of the legislature to have legislative maps in the public hearing process was viewed to be completely meaningless by the Supreme Court. They do not have the obligation to do that. Now, I will briefly, and if you could just bring up some of the Senate maps at issue, the Senate districts at issue, just describe in summary the findings of the court with regard to the Senate maps found out of compliance. With regard to districts 1 and 3, the court found there was a lack of compactness and improper use of geographic boundaries, and the improper use of geographic boundaries, both there were suggestions that they were boundaries were used sporadically and inconsistently, and some boundaries were creeks, and another boundary were minor roads, and they've found those to be insufficient. District 6 and 9. District 6 sacrifices, in the court's words, compactness and geographic boundaries when it was not necessary to do so to comply with the racial provisions of Tier 1. District 10 was found to be non-compact and appeared to protect an incumbent. District 30 was found to be non-compact and to split counties, cities, and geographical features where those were not required to comply with other standards. And districts 29 and 34 were found to have violated compactness without the Senate having performed a functional analysis of the type I described earlier, which, in the court's view, was indicative of a political intent. Improper political intent. And that is my report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miros. Members, do we have any questions for Mr. Miros? Representative Kier, you're recognized for a question. So it's on the record, why don't we make sure that the mic is on and so everybody can hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miros, with regard to District 34, I'm just curious. I know in the order, I believe it stated the courts up another alternative District 34 that was, I guess, submitted by, I don't know if it was the League of Women's Voters map or something of that nature. And I'm wondering, was that just a recommendation of how it should be, or were they almost mandating that the legislature draw it that way in order to comply? I was kind of curious about that.
Are you talking about how to read the order?
No. If you look at, I can't remember which page it's on. There, the court. Oh, actually, I just opened it up on page 171. It talks about District 34 and how it was very much out of whack, and then it shows District 29, which would be the District 34 that was submitted by the. I guess the coalition, and it says the coalition has submitted an alternative plan that shows a different configuration for this area that is more compact overall. So I guess was the court basically stating that this is more in line with how the area should be made, or were they mandating that we draw it that way, or were they just giving, was that almost like dicta? So I'm just curious.
I think, as I said before, when the court talks about alternative plans, it's to try to determine whether there are other ways to comply with the standards that would show that there could be a better attempt. Mm-hmm. The court said at this very point that the role of alternative plans is not to select the best plan. It's just it is probative of how one might do it. So I would certainly not suggest the court is indicating how to draw the map. It is saying that by virtue of an alternative plan, it saw ways to comply where the Senate map, in their view, did not.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
We follow.
Then another question I had, it seemed like in your testimony, there may have been two conflicting statements. Maybe it was, and I appreciate you, letting us know what went on in court. But I believe at the beginning, it almost appeared that you stated that the court indicated that where an incumbent lives or doesn't live doesn't evidence intent. But then you stated that the court appeared to state that the fact that in the Senate map there were no two incumbents drawn within each other did evidence intent. And I was actually wondering if you could, did I understand that correctly?
I did not say that about the Senate map. What I said was the position of an incumbent in connection with the shape of the district can be probative. So if, in fact, in whoever's map, you have an area that doesn't have substantial minority voting strength and you don't have other compelling reasons to have some irregular shape, but in that irregular appendage, there is an incumbent who is unpaired with another incumbent. That is probative of intent. It is not determinative by any stretch. It is evidence of intent. But really what that goes to is what we talked about before, and that is good faith effort to comply with each of the standards takes away the notion of suspicious or pretextual reasons why you're doing something. So if, in fact, you have an irregular shape, but you say that irregularity is because of this county boundary or because of this city boundary or because of this interstate, then that would argue substantially against wherever that incumbent might live. But if one cannot see other reasons to do so other than some sort of improper intent, then that can be indicative of a political motive.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
For a follow-up.
The courts, as you know, upheld the House map 7-0. And when I was reading through the order, it appeared that the court determined that the House did it appropriately, but the Senate utilized an entirely different method in enacting its map. And I was just wondering, so the mistake isn't made again, if you could just please tell us, you know, why was it that the House map was upheld 7-0, but the Senate map, because it was done differently, was overturned 5-2? And I just wanted to ask that because I just want to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes in the Senate map.
Well, I think if I could, let me answer that one for you, Mr. Miros. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the opinions, which you have in front of you. So, I mean, if you want to know an explanation as to why they unanimously supported our map and invalidated the Senate map, it's written out over 230 pages, and you can read it. I think what's important, though, is that they gave the Senate specific direction. Frankly, they gave the legislature specific direction and defined, frankly, the standards that Mr. Muros just gave us. And so the hope and the expectation is that both the Senate and the House, now that we have those expectations, now that we have those definitions now from the court, they can take those definitions, they can take the districts that were specifically targeted in that opinion and try to make sure that we are compliant the second time. So if there's anything you want to add to that, but I think that's the direction we're going in. I think the Senate is taking that charge very seriously. I can assure you this committee and our chamber will take that charge very seriously. The court was anything but ambiguous. They were very direct and very specific about what needed to be done.
One more follow, Mr. Chair?
With a follow-up.
And that kind of leads them to my last question I was going to ask. And I wanted to ask about how ambiguous and specific the order was. I know, Mr. Miros, in your testimony, you seemed very direct and very specific. But then as you went into it, you said there were specific areas where the court actually set down rules that you have to follow. And so my question is, was the court very specific? Is everything that you said exactly what the court said, almost like the black letter of the law, or was that your interpretation? Was that your interpretation of the order? Could it have been interpreted differently by somebody else?
I tried to use either very close paraphrases or quotations in what I had given you. Now, having said that, I did mention in compactness there were indications of how compactness would be applied, but by no stretch a determinative analysis. Visual comparisons are relevant but not determinative. Mathematical evaluations, again, are relevant but not determinative. The need to diverge from a perfect shape in order to comply with other standards, all of which are relevant. So there is no way that one can say that there is only one way to do that. With geographic and political boundaries, the court was more specific that creeks and minor roads are insufficient to be a reasonable geographic or political boundary. With regard to the minority protections, the court said that federal case law on Section 2 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is persuasive, very persuasive, but it did not say that it would in no instance in the future interpret something somewhat differently than a federal case. And so there are guidelines, there are statements that in some ways are categorical and others not. So you really have to look at it as a whole and each specific provision. But I did not try to distill this into Meros on Florida constitutional law.
I have one more follow-up.
One last follow-up for Representative Gere.
My last one. The last question I had pertained to, you spoke about the partisan the composition of the districts. And I believe that you stated that, you know, after you follow the different tiers, whatever the partisan makeup of the district doesn't have any indication of intent to favor or disfavor a political party. My question is, though, just like you stated where two incumbents are in the same, that could be evidence, circumstantial evidence of intent. Couldn't the fact if a map leans very partisan one way or the other, that could in fact be circumstantial evidence that there is an intent to favor or disfavor a political party?
If there appears to be good faith compliance with the standards, no. I think the court made it very clear that, and the notion was made in debate on the floor here and in briefing in the Florida Supreme Court, that the fact that the House map had a perceived imbalance of Republicans of 75 whatever is of no relevance absent other suggestions of violations of the actual standards. And what I think the error was, not in the court but in the arguments, was the notion that a partisan imbalance reflects necessarily an intent to effect that result. And the court said no. What fair means in fair districts is compliance with the standards. And as I told this committee long ago, if you make a good faith effort to comply with these standards, the result matters not whatsoever. And so in some instances, if there is lack of compliance in some areas or inconsistent or not readily discernible effort to comply, then perhaps. But if there is a good faith effort to comply, no, it does not matter.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Meros, thank you very much for your presentation and, again, for all of your service. Members, that concludes today's meeting. Again, you should expect that we will not be meeting at all next week. Rather, we expect to be back here March 26th, 27th, and 28th. If you have any questions or need assistance at this time, please reach out to our staff. They are here to help in any way, shape, or form. Thank you all again, and look forward to seeing everybody in a little more than a week. I think with that, Representative Dorworth moves we rise.
Thank you.